Is there trouble with the ceasefire deal?
Some Israeli analysts say there is no guarantee that they will reach a final agreement.
A look at the state of human rights in Africa.
Protests are being clamped down on, people who are pushing for their rights, you know, or to even comment on government policies and measures.
And a look at J.D. Vance, who becomes the 50th Vice President of the United States on Monday.
Now, when I proposed to my wife, I said, honey, I come with $120,000 worth of law school debt and a cemetery plot on a mountainside in eastern Kentucky.
Today is Friday, January 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. The ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas that was seen as a relief to so many on Wednesday is now causing concern in Tel Aviv. Israel's hardline national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said on Thursday that he would resign from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government if it ratifies the Gaza ceasefire deal, a deal that he strongly opposes. The deal that is taking shape is a reckless deal, Ben-Gvir said in a televised statement, saying it would erase the achievements of the war by releasing hundreds of Palestinian militants and withdrawing from strategic areas in Gaza, leaving Hamas undefeated. Additionally, just hours after the Prime Minister of Qatar announced the first stage of the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, the talks hit a snag when Netanyahu accused Hamas of backtracking on parts of that deal. Hamas has denied the accusation. Netanyahu delayed a meeting of the Israeli cabinet to approve the deal, raising questions about whether it could be implemented on Sunday as planned. Linda Gradstein has the story from Jerusalem.
Israelis are eagerly awaiting the release of 98 hostages, both alive and dead, whom Hamas has been holding since October 7, 2023, when the militant group killed 1,200 people and kidnapped 250 others in a raid on southern Israel. In the first stage of the ceasefire agreement, set to begin Sunday, Hamas will free 33 hostages, women, children, and the elderly, including two dual American-Israeli citizens. Israel will free hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. But some in Israel are skeptical that Hamas will keep its promises. Until now, Hamas has refused to provide a list of which hostages are still alive. Udi Gorin's cousin, Tal Haimi, was killed fighting on October 7, 2023, and his body taken to Gaza.
What happens when Hamas says, you know, we can't find your cousin. Sorry, we don't know where he is. What do we do? Do we break down the deal? Do we have the international backup, the guarantees that we were given to make sure that, all right, if this is what Hamas does, then the deal ends.
According to the deal, discussions on a long-term truce are set to start 16 days into the ceasefire. Some Israeli analysts say there is no guarantee that they will reach a final agreement. Jonathan Conricus is a former Israeli army spokesman.
Ceasefires have a tendency of turning from temporary to less temporary and more permanent. That would be a very bad scenario for Israel, for Israeli security, and it would be, I think, horrible for Gazans because that would leave them in an interim situation where, on one hand, Hamas continues to govern and Hamas is still in control, but Hamas is too weak to actually do anything useful for Gaza.
Palestinians in Gaza say they are happy to see an end to 15 months of Israeli attacks that Hamas says have killed more than 46,000 people and decimated the territory. Fadi Naim, a resident of Gaza City, says he is happy to return to his home, but people have lost many family members. The ceasefire would also mean a large increase in humanitarian aid entering Gaza. The World Food Program said it had 80,000 tons of food waiting outside Gaza or en route. Meanwhile, Palestinians say Israeli attacks on Gaza continue. The Hamas-run health ministry said at least 80 Palestinians were killed by Israeli airstrikes since Wednesday. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Looking now at Ukraine, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers have died in fighting since Russia invaded the country in February 2022, and some of those killed have been women. Tatiana Kurkurika met with two families who lost loved ones in the war. Anna Rice narrates her story.
If you think you can imagine how much destruction Russia's crimes have caused in Mariupol, just know that you are nowhere close to what's happening in reality.
This video message was recorded by combat medic Alena Kushnir-Novitska. She fought in the Azov Battalion, now called the Azov Brigade, in 2014. Her father, Mykola Novitsky, says he warned her about the hardships of combat.
I just told her, kid, it's a tough thing to do, especially for a woman.
During Russia's invasion, Kushnir-Novitska was rescuing military personnel and civilians in Mariupol and taking them to safety.
We medics are trying to help not just the military, but also civilians, around the clock under enemy artillery fire because ambulances can't make their way here.
Novitsky last saw his daughter in person on February 26, 2022. He last spoke to her the following month.
When we talked, she said, "Dad, if there is hell anywhere, it is here."
Kushnir-Novitska died saving others from a Russian bomb in April 2022. She was 30.
We came to visit you, Alonka, my dear girl, the best thing that happened in my life.
Here's the classroom where our Ina would sit. At this desk over here. This girl always had a goal and a sense of purpose. It's hard to believe she is no longer with us. It's painful to bury such children and think of them in the past tense.
Khmelnytsky native Inna Nyavkevich decided to join the military at 18 while in school.
Our dad was against it. He said, "How is this appropriate for an 18-year-old girl? Why would you do that?" But she went to a military commissariat and enlisted.
She was sent to Volnovakha in the Donetsk region.
She would try and calm us down. At the time, it was difficult for us to imagine what was happening to her, what she witnessed. She never once said it was hard for her.
Inna Nyavkevich served in an artillery division. She died in August 2023 under shelling in the Pokrovsky district, 2 days after her 20th birthday.
It doesn't feel real that she's gone. Only when I come here, I start to understand it's real. But I still cannot accept it.
Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said last month that 43,000 Ukrainians had been killed in combat since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. The war will mark its three-year anniversary next month. For Tatiana Kukurika in the Khmelnytsky region of Ukraine, NRI's VOA News.
Human Rights Watch has found that African governments continue to crack down and wrongly arrest political opponents, critics, activists, and journalists. The rights group also says armed forces and armed groups in some African countries have targeted civilians, killing them or driving them from their homes. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The conflict in Sudan and Ethiopia feature prominently in a Human Rights Watch report released Thursday. It says that in Sudan, the war between armed forces and the rebel Rapid Support Forces has displaced 12 million people, destroyed infrastructure, and blocked humanitarian assistance. In Ethiopia, rights group investigators found that government forces in the Amhara region committed widespread attacks against medical professionals, patients, and health facilities. Mosi Segun is the head of the Human Rights Watch Africa Division. She says armed conflict is not the only form of rights violation on the continent.
On top of all of that, you have all of the civic space restriction abuses, you know, including just the intolerance for freedom of expression, intolerance for freedom of association and assembly. Protests are being clamped down on, people who are pushing for their rights, you know, or to even comment on government policies and measures are being hunted down. Here in East Africa, we are seeing a very disturbing trend towards abductions.
Kenya has captured the attention of human rights groups for recent alleged abductions of anti-government protesters and activists from foreign countries, some of whom have been deported to Turkey and Uganda. The Human Rights Watch report also focuses on the seemingly endless conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where civilians are killed, women raped, and attacks on camps for the internally displaced continue to push more people into neighboring countries. Congo has accused Rwanda for supporting M23 rebels, an allegation Rwanda denies. Clementine de Monsieur, Human Rights Watch senior researcher, says the expansion of conflict worsens civilians' harm.
It's certainly a concern to see the regionalization of the conflict. We've seen in the past cycles of violence in eastern Congo and across the Great Lakes region that have had a devastating impact on civilian populations. And we're not seeing significant signs of pressure on the different parties to the conflict to reduce violations and harm to civilians.
The report notes that countries in West Africa ruled by the military, like Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, have cracked down on opposition and dissent, freedom of expression, and backsliding in the fight against corruption. It notes that in southern Africa, Mozambique is grappling with post-election violence in which hundreds of people have been killed. Elizabeth Kamundia, Deputy Director of Disability Rights at Human Rights Watch, says conflict and violence are causing a rise in disabilities.
We have seen a rise in the number of people acquiring injuries that lead to disabilities. We've seen increased psychological distress and mental health impacts on people, families, communities as a result of war and conflict. We've seen difficulties with access to medication for people who have mental health conditions, and therefore they are forced to stop their treatment.
Human Rights Watch's newly released World Report reviewed human rights records of more than 100 countries, including 25 in Africa. Despite the widespread abuses and violence against people in Africa, HRW notes that, like the rest of the world, African people are resisting and pushing back against autocratic rule and abuse of their rights. It notes they are also mobilizing on social media and streets to demand an end to the abuses and bad governance that has contributed to divisions and conflict among communities. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
The hot, dry, and powerful winds that drove the wildfires in Southern California have eased some, and firefighters report significant gains against the two massive fires burning around Los Angeles. However, dry conditions and gusty winds are expected to linger. More improvements in the weather are expected later this weekend, and that should help fire crews allow some residents to return to their neighborhoods. So far, the fires have killed at least 25 people and destroyed more than 10,000 buildings.
UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky have signed a 100-year partnership agreement. It's part of a European show of support to continue helping Ukraine prevail in its nearly three-year war with Russia. Starmer said the landmark century-long agreement commits the two sides to cooperate on defense and on technology projects, including drones.
Filmmaker David Lynch has died at 78 years old. He was celebrated for his uniquely dark vision in such movies as Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive and the TV series Twin Peaks. The cause of his death was not immediately made public, but Lynch had been vocal about the effect emphysema had had on his life. Lynch broke through in the 1970s with the surreal film Eraserhead, and he rarely failed to startle and inspire audiences and peers in the following decades.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Time now for a look at U.S. politics. Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Mike Johnson named Republican Representative Rick Crawford to be the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. It's the latest promotion of an ally of President-elect Donald Trump to a key national security post. Johnson tapped Crawford one day after taking the unusual step of removing Representative Mike Turner from the chairmanship that he held for nearly 2 years. Turner, a proponent of NATO and a backer of aid for Ukraine, said late on Wednesday that he had been removed from the committee, telling CBS News that Johnson had cited concerns from Mar-a-Lago from the decision. Johnson denied to reporters that he was ordered to relieve Turner, saying it was a House decision.
A source familiar with the matter questioned whether an order for Turner's ouster came from Mar-a-Lago, saying it appeared the decision was made by Johnson, who wanted his own person as committee chair. The source also noted that Turner voted to certify outgoing President Joe Biden's victory over Trump in the 2020 election, while Crawford joined 139 Republican House members and 8 senators in voting to overturn the result. This is a pattern for Johnson, said the source, pointing to the appointment of Brian Mast, who also opposed Biden's victory, as the new House Foreign Relations Committee chairman to replace Mike McCaul, who voted to confirm it.
And sticking with U.S. politics, Donald Trump isn't the only one being inaugurated on Monday. The vice president also has a moment in the spotlight to take the oath of office.
Republican Vice President-elect J.D. Vance rose from humble beginnings. He grew up in a struggling industrial town in Ohio. He went on to attend an Ivy League school and now will be one of the youngest vice presidents in history. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti takes us back to his roots.
J.D. Vance, minutes after he was elected as Vice President of the United States.
After the greatest political comeback in American history, we're going to lead the greatest economic comeback in American history under Donald Trump's leadership.
This stage is a long way from the back roads of Middle America. Jackson, Kentucky isn't where Vance was born, but this is where he calls home.
Now, when I proposed to my wife, I said, honey, I come with $120,000 worth of law school debt and a cemetery plot on a mountainside in eastern Kentucky.
Breathitt County, Kentucky Sheriff John Holland drives us on a dusty dirt road and parks on a slight hill. He opens a rusty gate to show us that plot.
Grandmother Bonnie Blanton Vance.
Vance's grandmother was known as Mama.
He always came down here with Mamaw, and she would bring him to the mountains to let him see what mountain life was, and he evidently liked it.
Vance was born here in Middletown, Ohio, and raised mainly by his strict Mama, who cursed a lot and kept 19 loaded handguns in the house. With his stepfather's last name, J.D. Hamill won his first election, ironically as vice president of his Middletown high school class. He served as a Marine and then graduated summa cum laude from The Ohio State University. Then on to Yale, where Vance clicked with fellow law student Usha Chillicorde, his future wife. Vance became known nationally through his 2016 bestseller-turned-movie, Hillbilly Elegy, about working-class America. It stars Glenn Close as a blunt mama to a young J.D.
But you got to decide. You want to be somebody? Or not.
With the support of then-former President Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, the boy from Ohio who loves Kentucky, was elected as a senator from Ohio. And a quick 2 years later,
J.D. Vance to be the next vice president of the United States.
Trump chose Vance as his running mate, but he got off to a rough start, having previously called Trump, quote, reprehensible, and having claimed to be, quote, a never Trump guy. Now, Vance's policies reflect Trump's. And when asked, did the former president lose the 2020 election?
No. I think there are serious problems in 2020. So did Donald Trump lose the election? Not by the words that I would use.
Vance is hawkish on China and East Asia, opposes military aid to Ukraine, and...
Ma'am.
In answer to my question on the Israel-Hamas conflict,
Kamala Harris on the one hand says that she really cares about civilian casualties, and yet she refuses to give Israel the weapons that allow them to minimize civilian casualties.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Vance, at age 40, will be the third youngest vice president in history.
Let's get to work and make it happen.
Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
No matter who's on the stage, a presidential inauguration is one of the largest, most logistically complex, and most secure events on the calendar in Washington. Joining me for a look at what's going on is VOA's chief national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Coming up on Monday, Donald Trump's inauguration. It's always one of the biggest events of the year and years in which they happen here in Washington. I know you and I have seen them before. What can people expect if they come? How many people are coming to the city? What's it going to be like?
Well, officials in Washington, including the police, the mayor, others, the Secret Service, are saying that they expect hundreds of thousands of people to descend on Washington for Monday's inauguration itself, but also for the host of balls, other inaugural events, celebrations, and also for about 10 to 12 permanent protest events that are going to start happening over the weekend, starting on Saturday. And all this is going to come together. Of course, the main event is the inauguration on Monday, and all this will come together for one big celebration of democracy in Washington, D.C.
Now, help set the stage for our listeners who haven't been to Washington, D.C. Donald Trump will be speaking on the steps of the Capitol building, which is at one end of the National Mall. And as you say, hundreds of thousands of people are expected to watch this. How much room is there for them?
Well, if you come to visit Washington and you visit the National Mall on a random given day, it's a nice wide open space going from the Capitol all the way to the Lincoln Memorial. There are museums on the side. You can see people running, jogging, walking their dogs, playing sports.
It's about 3 kilometers long.
It's a big amount of space. But if you look at it now, even as we're speaking, there are fences up everywhere. It's been made much smaller. There are checkpoints that are being erected. If you have a ticket to go to the inauguration event itself, you'll be able to get in. Other people will be to the inaugurational space near the Capitol. Other people will be able to come to the mall. But if you don't know where you're going to run into a lot of barriers, especially as you get to the mall in the Capitol area.
Now, you mentioned the security checkpoints and the police officers. No doubt security is going to be a top priority for authorities. Can you tell us what kind of protections are in place and what steps have authorities taken to keep the event safe?
Well, there's going to be a lot of law enforcement on hand. Officials say they expect 25,000 law enforcement officers and also military personnel. There are 4,000 police officers about that are coming from out of town, from other police jurisdictions around the country to help with this event. And of course, you're going to have Secret Service officers everywhere, making sure that the president and the other dignitaries at this event are going to be safe. So how does this play out? Well, they're going to be manning about 48 kilometers, 30 miles of what they call anti-scale fence that is going up, a lot of it already up around the Capitol in the mall. There are concrete barriers. Roads are being closed. If you're here on the inauguration day itself on Monday, there are going to be officers, Secret Service agents, military personnel on rooftops. There will be drones in the sky. And in addition to the road closures, they're taking additional precautions. Some of the subway stops in Washington, D.C., the metro stops, some of them are going to be closed, some of them are going to be partially closed in order to control the flow of people who are coming downtown into the Capitol area to see President-elect Trump sworn in.
Now, I think it's fair to say it's no surprise, really, that there are people, there are terrorist organizations, there are countries, there are other bad actors, lone wolves, who might want to hurt large numbers of people or disrupt the inaugural process. Do we know of any specific threats that we should be looking out for?
Well, look, we got to start by saying that for a while, officials in the U.S. have been worried, accusing Iran of trying to target President-elect Donald Trump, the former president of the United States, as well as other officials from his previous administration, in retaliation for the U.S. killing of the Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the IRGC Quds Force for Iran during Trump's first term. So that's always been a concern. In terms of this inauguration, the FBI says that it has no specific or credible evidence of any threat to any of the activities taking place. That said, though, officials say this is a higher threat environment than that they've seen in years past. And the main threat is what they call the lone actor, the lone wolf, somebody who has a grievance against a politician, a group, a political viewpoint, and they decide to use an event like this to take out their grievances and try to launch some sort of event or attack that could hurt people. So that's really their main focus. That's what they're watching out for. That's the reason for so many of the barriers. They're not necessarily worried about some sort of concerted terrorist attack with weapons or some sort of military invasion. They're worried about individuals who are inspired by their own grievances or a cause that they've taken up from a terrorist group or an extremist group, and that they want to act out on those beliefs. And so that's the hardest threat to detect. It's the hardest one to stop. And that's why so many of these precautions, so many of these barriers, the fencing is all going up all around Washington, D.C. to make sure the president-elect and everybody celebrating and marking this transition of power in the United States is safe.
VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Seldon. Jeff, thanks for your reporting, and stay safe on Monday.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.